Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Well, this is our last live show of the year, and I want to begin today by thanking all of you for your support, your emails, and your calls. This has been a very intense year, and it is definitely one we will never forget. I also want to give a huge thanks to Your Call producer Leah Cesarine and Your Call senior producer Malihe Razazan for their incredible work this year. Leah and Malihe have done an amazing job of coming up with show ideas, finding incredible guests, changing the show at the very last minute, or finding new guests when people cancel at the last minute. The show requires a lot of juggling, and they both bring so much passion to the show, and I cannot thank them enough. I also want to thank our studio engineers, Kevin Vance, Damian Miner, David LaTulipe, and Debbie Kennedy. They are still coming to the studio as we're all working remotely to make sure that this show and the station stays on the air. So thank you so much. Over the next couple of weeks, we are going to bring you some of our favorite shows. We are planning to take a much needed break, so we are refreshed to dive back in and cover all the issues you've come to expect from us in 2021. As you know, that we've always been dedicated to covering inequality on this show, but this year has really been like no other. The level of inequality that we are seeing has widened drastically under COVID. Over the past 5 months, 8 million more people have fallen into poverty, according to researchers from the University of Chicago and the University of Notre Dame. It is the biggest jump in a single year since the U.S. government began tracking poverty 60 years ago. And economists say this is happening because obviously millions of people cannot find jobs, and unemployment benefits have gone from more than $900 a week in July to about $300 a week in August. People just cannot make ends meet. So why is it taking Congress so long to come up with another relief bill? Well, House Democrats passed a bill months ago, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has refused to support it. His main sticking point is that he wants to give corporations immunity from COVID lawsuits. Joining us with the latest are two guests, two of some of our favorite Friday guests. David Dayan is executive editor of The American Prospect, and author of the great book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rose.
Great to have you. Arthur Delaney is a reporter at the Huffington Post. Hi, Arthur. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Well, great to have both of you. Before we dive in and talk about where we are right now with this bill, David, can you begin first and tell us how we got here? Why has it taken so long for Congress to pass another bill?
Well, back in March, when the economy was tumbling, and in particular when stock markets were tumbling, that really inspired Republicans to act and come to the table and ask how they could rescue corporate America, essentially. And once that was done, there just wasn't much incentive for Republicans to get back there and come to the table for a deal. There was some incentive for Trump right before the election, but Mitch McConnell was disinterested in pursuing that. And, you know, he didn't do too badly with the Senate in the election, so maybe he was proven right on that. Now there's this belief that the Georgia Senate elections rely on getting some relief, additional relief to the American people. And so that's why Republicans, in my view, are back at the table.
Right. And we'll give people more details about that, because I think this just came out this week, right, about what McConnell has said about that Georgia race behind closed doors.
Correct. Yeah.
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 Arthur, how would you explain this? I mean, it's absolutely shocking and shameful that Congress knows that so many people are struggling right now, and yet it has taken months to agree to a deal.
I think David Dayan's answer is good. There was definitely, things were way scarier in March, and the stock market went down fast, and they sprang to action, but thought the pandemic would be over in a matter of months and set everything to expire over the summer. And now stuff is expiring at the end of this month. And I think there are a few reasons that it's been so difficult to reauthorize and do more. And one is I think Republicans thought Trump was going to lose the election and didn't want to spend any more money to try to help him out, because they have a couple ideological reasons they don't like spending money. One is, you know, they it adds to the debt, which, you know, that concern comes and goes. But another is they're not all that mad if people are poorer. They don't mind if people are losing their jobs, because that advantages the employers, who are the people they talk to the most, their donors. And, you know, any economic policy that comes up on Capitol Hill, no matter what's going on in the economy, the constant refrain when you talk to Republicans is that employers in my districts can't find workers. So, you know, bad labor market is good from the employer perspective, and giving money to the workers increases their power vis-a-vis employers. So they're, you know, it doesn't help business owners. So I think that actually goes a long way to explaining beyond the electoral dynamics that have been at play.
And David, can you tell us, when you look at Mitch McConnell really obsessing over giving corporations immunity from COVID lawsuits, how much of a factor was that in holding up this bill?
Well, for many months, that was his red line. I mean, if he had already saved corporate America through the bailout programs in the March bill, I guess his thinking was, well, what else can I get? And corporate liability, which goes well beyond just COVID-related lawsuits, but would prevent enforcement of things like the WARN Act, which is supposed to give notice for large mass-scale layoffs, things like the Federal Labor Standards Act, or at least portions of it. It was a really aggressive and radical bill. And he said for very many months that this was his red line in talks. And Democrats did hold pretty firm on that. And finally, when this Georgia thing came up and McConnell, you know, was more interested in saving his Senate majority, he said, OK, you can drop that, but I'm going to take something in exchange. And the thing that in exchange for dropping the liability shield, McConnell said, well, you have to drop the money that goes to state and local governments to fill their budget shortfalls. And so that's where we're proceeding right now. Neither the liability shield or the state and local government relief are in this bill.
And Arthur, the Democrats wanted $160 billion for state and local governments, because we know that state and local governments are really struggling right now. And they said that this money would help people keep their jobs. It would also help transit systems, schools, and vaccine distribution.
It would. It's actually one of the best ways to stimulate the economy is to help out states. And that's according to an analysis by the Congressional Budget Office. And $160 billion is much less than what Democrats had previously sought in the HEROES Act and in its subsequent iterations. So they climbed down a lot on that and are ultimately letting it go, but saying some of the other provisions that are on the table right now will help states out with transit and other more targeted costs. And I wanted to mention something I left out of my last answer. When Republicans saw that Trump was, you know, a likely loser, they were looking ahead toward the Biden administration. And in addition to not caring that much about workers, a bad economy hurts a Biden administration. And we know from the Obama years that they'll work against the economy if it's to their advantage electorally. And Mitch McConnell has famously said he wanted to make Obama a one-term president, and that was a key to his thinking on all sorts of stuff in the Senate.
Yeah, let me agree with Arthur on that. That's absolutely right that McConnell's thinking at that time was, I don't want to put together a $2 trillion package that is going to make Biden, who's going to win the election anyway, waltz into the Oval Office and be able to have a good economy going forward. So and that's kind of motivating, or at least what people think is motivating, the main sticking point right now to a deal, which is the elimination of these Federal Reserve lending programs, which Democrats think ties the hands of Biden on the way in, and the ability to use the Federal Reserve and some money that's already been appropriated to provide some lending relief maybe to state and local governments, or maybe to small and medium-sized businesses. So, you know, the notion of sabotage kind of hangs over this whole thing. I kind of question whether the Fed programs really are worth saving, but that certainly is the impetus on the part of Republicans right now.
And so to give people information about what was uncovered about Mitch McConnell, I'm just reading from the New York Times on December 16th, a few days ago. Senator Mitch McConnell privately made the case to Republicans on Wednesday for a stimulus deal that includes another round of direct payments to struggling Americans, suggesting that delivering such help could boost the party's hopes of hanging on to their majority in the Senate. McConnell said Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, who are facing runoffs in Georgia in January, were, quote, getting hammered for Congress's failure to deliver more pandemic aid to struggling people, and that enacting the measure could help them. David, what was your response when you heard about this?
Well, first, it's just quite amazing to think about that David Perdue came up about 13,000 votes short of getting a simple majority in November, which means he would have been the 51st Republican senator. And if he would have gotten that 13,000 votes, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. Republicans, clearly by McConnell's words, would not be looking at any relief for the American people right now, which is absolutely stunning. But now we're in this situation where McConnell does feel like his majority is tied to winning those races and is tied to delivering some form of relief for the public. That creates a completely different dynamic in the leverage in the negotiations right now. Democrats have not had really any leverage in these negotiations since March. And the Georgia elections have provided sort of a new boost here to get something done. And Democrats can do something with that. They can get larger one-time payments out of it. They can get more weeks for unemployment insurance, because the extension right now that's on the table, as I understand it, would only extend $300 a week extra for 10 weeks, which is not sort of the duration of, you know, we're not going to be done with COVID in 10 weeks. They could try to get state and local again. You know, if McConnell really needs the bill, if he really needs a deal, then Democrats are in a position to dictate terms, and hopefully they will.
You know, Arthur, I mean, the fact that games are being played with people's lives, I mean, yes, this is happens with politics, but I mean, we're hearing stories. NPR ran a piece about a single mom, I believe it was in Texas, talking about how she got evicted. Two men and one man came into her apartment. They started taking the sheets off of her bed. They piled all of her stuff in these blankets, tied it up like a knapsack, and threw it off the balcony. I mean, her kids are traumatized over this. This is just one example of hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are losing their homes. Can you talk about how the media have been covering this? Because one thing that's really been bothering me is hearing that this is just partisan Washington. It's both sides who cannot get along. And that's just not factual.
I think it's the media has a hard time with the complexity of the stuff that's on the table in the negotiations, like the McConnell liability shield, which isn't on the table now, but isn't at the front of the table now, but has been sort of lurking for months, is sprawling. And it's difficult to give a short description of all the different things it does. So reporters wind up saying Democrats want aid for states and Mitch McConnell wants a liability shield. And it's just presented as two equal things. And I think it's, you know, everyone knows you're not supposed to give false equivalence to two different things, but in this case, it's particularly difficult not to, just because it's hard to describe unless you devote extra space in your stories to the liability shield, you know, which would, since I'm talking about it, I might as well say it would disallow enforcement of workplace safety standards. It would suspend enforcement of labor laws in situations where workers are complaining about a possible coronavirus exposure. It would allow the government to prosecute lawyers for sending demand letters to businesses. it would, you know, if you wanted to complain that you'd been exposed, you wanted to sue, you'd have to take it to federal court instead of state court. You'd have to itemize your contacts for 14 days before you're exposed. It goes on and on. Mm. And so anyway, in the context of the plague, it's sick, because it's not just like we're fiddling with how many people are unemployed and how much help they get. The context is, if you don't have support from the federal government, which is the only institution that can possibly help this many people, you gotta go out and risk exposure to a deadly virus in order to have income at a time when a vaccine is coming down the pike. Like if you could just pay people to hunker down, that would be great. It would save lives. And yet, even though Congress has already shown it can snap its fingers to deposit thousands of dollars in people's bank accounts and instantly make half their problems disappear, we're screwing around until the last second with weird Federal Reserve stuff, and it's very frustrating. I don't think that a lot of the media coverage really conveys all of that that's going on. You know, the scale of the suffering and the just weirdness that we're having a regular partisan debate about, like work incentives, in the middle of a plague that could be over soon.
Right. Yeah. David, what would you add?
I would just share Arthur's anger at this. The fact that there is this final beacon of hope that we have two vaccines that have been authorized by the FDA and that we're probably 6 months out from everybody being able to receive them and having something close to if not an eradication, then an extreme reduction of the severity of the virus. Unlike in March when it was kind of unknown, there is a time period here. We know that if we can just get people bridged through to this other side, that we really can protect virtually everybody, and we're dilly-dallying on it. And it really is frustrating. And I would just bring up one other thing that I covered the other day that hasn't really been talked about a lot, is that unemployment benefits are taxable. And that's true at the federal level, and it's true in 34 states. It's not true in California. California does not tax unemployment benefits, but in 34 other states they do, and federally they do. And most people don't take withholding out of unemployment benefits. And so think of the extreme level of unemployment benefit.
Nope. David? Did we lose David?
To pick up where he's going.
Yeah, go ahead, and
going,
David will come back. Go ahead.
The unemployment system is not good. It was shown to be a total omni-shambles earlier this year. They did put a lot on the state workforce agencies when they passed these new federal programs for gig workers and the long-term jobless and the extra $600. But those agencies, it's fair to say they totally fell on their faces collectively. Mm. And we're not even talking about doing a better unemployment system. I mean, Democrats have brought it up, but it doesn't get anywhere near the table. It's just left out as on the side, like it's a fringe thing that we could have an okay unemployment system, just doing its basic job. We could have a much better worker support system, and Democrats aren't even trying. We're not even fighting about that. We're just trying to get a few more dollars out through the creaky employer favoring system that we already have. And yeah, it's your benefits are taxable. There are errors in payments. All kinds of weird punitive things happen as a result of honest mistakes and errors by state agencies.
Arthur Delaney is a reporter at the Huffington Post. And David Dayan, are you still with us? Oh, I think we lost David. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us. David Dayan is executive editor of The American Prospect and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Arthur, for people who are in need of this unemployment, the deal, what is the latest with the deal? Because we thought we were going to get something at the beginning of the week, and now we're at Friday. So where does it stand?
Well, according to the top level, the unemployment is, they aren't really fighting about that. They're more upset about this Fed thing, but even the unemployment details aren't finalized yet. My understanding is that where they're at is they'll take the extra federal programs that were put in place in the CARES Act in March and just continue them for 3 more months. That's benefits for gig workers who are ineligible for regular unemployment compensation, and also an extra 13 weeks for the long-term jobless. Also, they will add another 10 weeks of eligibility. So if you already ran out of benefits, you can get benefits for 10 additional weeks, basically restart your claim as a result of this deal if it gets enacted. And what gets the most attention is they'll put another $300 on top. So that's less than the $600 they had in place earlier, but it's actually a big deal. It makes the unemployment benefits much closer to replacing a larger portion of your of workers' previous wage. And Congress has never done that before 2020. They never added hundreds of dollars to unemployment. So it's a short duration, this extension, but it is still a substantial amount of money. And it's nothing to sneeze at in the context of the history of the federal government's expansions of unemployment benefits in response to recessions.
When can people expect to receive the $600 check?
That's a great question. The IRS has had a little practice sending these checks out. I mean, they were kind of good at it to start with. Unlike the small business program, unlike the unemployment insurance getting funneled through these creaky state systems, the checks can go out fast. And I would think that if they pass something with checks in it, which it looks extremely likely if they get this done, that they'll have $600 in checks, that it would be a matter of weeks. I actually interviewed an unemployed person yesterday who said that the $300 in unemployment would be great, but he's got a problem with his claim. It's going to take a while to get sorted out, and he's really looking for the check because he knows the check would come fast. So if they get this done soon, I would expect the checks soon also.
Hey, this is David. I'm sorry.
Hi, David. Go ahead.
I got cut off before. Let me just add to that a little bit. It's true that the checks both would arrive more swiftly and also target people who are not targeted by the unemployment system, the elderly, children, people who are out of the workforce, people who have problems with their claims. It is also true that a GAO report from September found that 9 million people who were eligible for checks actually didn't get them. There's a question about mixed status households where there is one undocumented member within the household. Those people didn't get checks under the CARES Act. There's a question of whether eligibility will be given to them in this new set of checks.
I heard they would. I heard that was in yesterday.
That's good. That's very good. And then
that
also,
could change, but that was true yesterday, according to a source.
Also, a situation with our incarcerated people who were eligible for the CARES Act checks, but the IRS went to great lengths to try to block them. In fact, there was even a federal court order demanding that the IRS give these checks to incarcerated people who are completely entitled to them. And there were still problems with getting those checks out there. And there are also fees that are associated with applying for and then receiving checks in prison bank accounts. So there's a lot to be concerned with regard to the checks, even though there is a possibility that would broadly cover everybody rather than the unemployment system, which just covers those eligible for unemployment.
David, I know we have to let you go to get to a meeting. We've got a lot of small business owners who listen to the show. They're being hit so hard. What is, if anything, is in this bill for small businesses?
Well, there's a second round of the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program. This would allow businesses that were still suffering from the effects of the coronavirus to take a second draw. So even if they got a PPP loan and a forgivable loan the first time, they would be able to get a second draw of PPP loans the second time, and they've tightened up the eligibility. There's a claim that large businesses wouldn't be able to get it. That was a source of a lot of consternation within Congress the last time. We'll see what the language is on that and whether that gets tightened up. But in theory, this would allow businesses that were still suffering to get some additional relief.
Well, David, I know we have to let you go. Thank you so much for all of your great work this year, and thank you for joining us.
All right. Thanks, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays. David Dayan is executive editor of the American Prospect. Arthur, before we let you go, you do really important work on food banks and hunger. And it's just, again, been shocking to see the lines at food banks. They cannot keep up with demand. So many people say they just do not have enough money to put enough food on the table. How would this bill increase funding for SNAP? I heard someone this week on NPR say it makes so much more sense to increase SNAP because it allows people to make their own choices. First of all, it also gives a boost to, you know, your local grocery store. So what about SNAP?
That's right. Well, this is an example of where you have a big problem like hunger going up all across the country. You need a big solution. And the biggest one that the government has is SNAP. It's actually one of the biggest programs that the government has, period, in terms of economics. And it's the most responsive. And I am just pulling up what was in an earlier draft compromise that served as the basis for the current deal that leaders are negotiating. And it had a temporary increase in individual SNAP payments by 15% for 4 months. So that's a big deal. So more money for everyone getting SNAP benefits. You know, those are often called food stamps. And it would also maintain a lot of the ad hoc things that the USDA had done, such as SNAP benefits for people who have their children in child care and flexibilities with school meals, more money for senior nutrition services, you know, Meals on Wheels. But the big thing is SNAP, an extra 15% in monthly benefits. That would benefit tens of millions of people. Mm.
And again, any time frame when we think this bill might finally pass?
No. I mean, we were, you know, today is a government funding deadline. And, you know, we had expected the COVID relief to be tacked on to the government funding bill, but the government funding bill isn't done. And now there's a snag with just the COVID relief bill, with this Federal Reserve thing that Democrats are yelling about. So it looks like they will do a stopgap funding, probably a really short one, so that they could try to finish this all before Christmas. That's my guess. Hopefully they don't do it over the weekend, because I don't want, you know, that's difficult for me to cover.
Well, we really appreciate your work, Arthur, and we appreciate all the great work you've done this year. Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Stay safe and have a nice holiday with your family. Arthur Delaney is a reporter with the Huffington Post. And coming up after a break, we're going to talk about really an amazing investigation in Mother Jones on the COVID breakout at a Primex in California's Kern County. The report is called "Everyone is Tired of Staying Silent." Inside a worker rebellion in the Central Valley amid the pandemic, farm workers are demanding a seat at the table. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now I would like to welcome Julia Lurie to the show. Julia is a senior reporter at Mother Jones. Her latest cover story for the magazine takes an in-depth look at the plight of farm workers at Primex Farms. It's a nut packing facility in California's Kern County. Hundreds of workers have gone on strike to demand basic protections, and they also want a seat at the table. Hi, Julia. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for this incredible piece. I hope listeners can take some time to read it and look at these amazing photographs that you also include in your piece.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Can you just give us some overall information about farm workers in California? You know, we did shows, but I have to say it's been a couple months since we've done shows about the COVID outbreak among farm workers in California. How is it going now?
Sure. Yeah. So farm workers in California are an incredibly vulnerable population when it comes to COVID for a whole host of reasons. You know, many people live in dormitories for temporary workers where the virus can proliferate really easily. It's very common to carpool to job sites, and the Central Valley is known for having extremely poor air quality. So there's all these sort of like external factors that are already sort of creating the context for people to be like perfect targets for this virus. And so it didn't really come as a surprise when over the summer there was a huge outbreak, not just at this facility at Primex, but in general, the rates among among farm workers in the Central Valley were sky high, particularly in August. Since then, things got a little bit better, and now they appear to be going back up again, as they have been in so many other parts of the country.
We also talked about how hard it has been for farm workers to get their hands on basic PPE. And I'm guessing since nurses around the country and even in California are still struggling, farm workers are also still struggling to get that.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that that makes it really hard for people to even learn about this, learn about how hard it has been for farm workers, is the fact that, you know, so many farm workers are undocumented today, and there is not a whole lot of union presence among them for a whole host of historical reasons. And the result is that they don't necessarily have a voice, a seat at the table, as so many other industry groups might normally. So, you know, we hear about nurses who don't have PPE, we hear about teachers who don't have PPE, and we absolutely should. We don't hear as often about farm workers or packers who don't have PPE.
Mm. And Kern County, where so many farms are located, it's one of the hot spots for COVID. According to the LA Times, ICU capacity in this area is below 15%. Residents have been asked to stay home. Over the past 7 days, the county has reported an average of 1,038 new cases per day, which is a 146% increase from 2 weeks ago. And over that same period, there's been one death per day.
Yeah, and I think that one thing to keep in mind here, and again, this is not unique to agricultural workers specifically, but is just that there's not much of an option to stay home. You know, mm-hmm. if you're being told that you're not going to get paid for your days out, for example, you're not going to get paid if you quarantine, and you're already living paycheck to paycheck, it's pretty hard to rationally decide to stay home. And that's not a decision that people are making happily, obviously. Everyone who I talked to would much rather have stayed home. But it's a matter of sort of being stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, either you're able to put food on the table or you're not.
You focused on Primex Farms, which is a nut packing facility in California's Kern County. Primex processes about 6% of the state's pistachios, most of which are exported. Can you just give us a little bit of information about Primex and the working conditions on that farm before COVID hit?
Sure. Yeah. So Primex is a nut packing facility in Wasco, which is in Kern County. It's surrounded by miles and miles of almond and pistachio groves. And there are about 400 people who work at the packing facility. So these are employees who are working indoors. And primarily what a lot of people are doing is they're sorting the nuts. So they're taking out nuts that are blemished or in some way not good for packing. And from the start of the pandemic, the company hadn't had particularly good practices when it came to preventing COVID. It has actually banned employees from wearing masks at the start of the pandemic, according to several workers. That eventually changed, but still over the summer, people started getting sick. People were coughing. They were trying to stay home from work. But the company, again, according to employees, denied that there was a COVID problem and encouraged employees to keep coming in. And employees reported that they weren't getting paid for the days that they did stay out sick. So eventually this all came to a head when over the summer, a local news station broke the news that, according to the company, 31 people at this facility had been diagnosed with the coronavirus. Now, this came as a huge surprise to the workers who hadn't been told about this at all from the company. And understandably, they were outraged at having been kept in the dark like that. And so eventually, they decided to go on strike. They decided to have a picket line outside of the packing facility and basically refused to go to work until this issue was solved, until there was more communication around what was happening.
You write that in late June, OSHA opened an investigation, and by mid-September, the employee lead count found that 97 of Primex's 400 employees tested positive, along with more than 60 family members. A week later, a mobile testing unit provided by the company would find that a total of 150 employees had been infected. So this is 150 employees out of 400.
Yeah, it was a huge spread of a virus. You know, employees that I've talked to feel like this could have been prevented, or at least could have definitely been slowed down had it been, you know, nipped in the bud.
You write that in mid-July, a 57-year-old Primex employee named Maria Hortensia Lopez was taken off life support. Did she pass because of COVID?
She did. She passed away due to the coronavirus. As far as I know, she is the only employee at Primex who passed away. There were some others who were in very, very serious medical condition, and had to miss a lot of work, obviously. So this really threw, you know, hundreds of people for a loop, not only the Primex workers, but as you mentioned, their family members as well. Mm. And I think that, you know, one thing that people might not appreciate is like just the decision to go on strike among agricultural workers is incredibly rare. Mm. You know, less than 2% of farm workers are unionized across the country. So they don't have the legal or the financial support of a union. Like I said before, many people are undocumented, living paycheck to paycheck. So within that context, there's not really like, no rational worker decides to go on strike unless they really reach a breaking point.
Well, and so tell us more about how this was organized. You start your piece off by introducing us to Veronica Perez. You write that Veronica arrived at Primex Farms early in the morning on June 25th at 4:30 a.m. She would usually stand next to other sorters alongside a conveyor belt picking out blemished pistachios. But on that day, early in the morning for the next 5 hours, she and about 40 of her coworkers formed a picket line. Even more circled and honked their cars, and they held signs with the names of coworkers who had the virus. So tell us more about the protest and how these workers organized.
So after the news came out, the local news came out, that 31 people had been infected, Veronica basically was instrumental in starting this group text thread among employees at the company. And it was for anyone who was concerned about the coronavirus and wanted to organize around that. And within 24 hours of her starting this WhatsApp thread, 100 members of the company, so a quarter of the company, was on this text thread. And they were texting about how concerned they were. And they decided to meet over Zoom. This was just the day after the news came out. And then the day after that, they formed that picket line. So a lot of people were there, you know, in person with signs. Some people who were themselves sick or concerned that they may be sick joined from their cars. And this generated a fair amount of local publicity. So within hours, you had Primex saying that they were going to temporarily close the facility for cleaning. They were going to, you know, take measures to prevent the spread in the future. They were going to set up this mobile testing unit that would later find, you know, the 150 people who were infected. So it was definitely a case of, you know, the publicity not being good for the company and that forcing change. But you had workers really going out on a limb in order to get to that point.
Yeah, right. And when workers do go on a limb to get to this point, what is the connection between workers and United Farm Workers?
Sure. So United Farm Workers is the big farm worker union. And they not only represent people who are part of the union, but they often just work with other workers who are striking just to provide organizational support and advice, that kind of thing. So when Veronica, for example, was trying to organize her coworkers, she had no experience organizing before. She had never, like, you know, led a strike or anything like that. She actually reached out to the UFW saying, like, what do you suggest that I do? And it was them who suggested, you know, starting this thread, trying to demonstrate. And throughout, she had been in touch with them just about next steps to take. So the UFW, even though the membership isn't huge, the presence is quite big, especially in the Central Valley.
In addition to demanding basic protections, farm workers also said that they want a seat at the table. How did the company respond to that?
You know, I think that the company, specifically Primex's response to this strike has been quite telling. On the one hand, you saw this immediate, you know, these immediate changes. They put up more like plexiglass so that workers wouldn't be in contact with each other so much. They had this mobile testing unit. But at the same time, it did not become a welcoming place for workers who were speaking out. And in fact, shortly after the strikes, a number of workers were terminated. Now, organizers will say that these were primarily the workers who were the most vocal, that they were fired. Primex will say these were seasonal reductions. This is people who were being staffed through a temporary agency, and we would have gotten rid of them anyway. What we know for sure is that the day after those people were terminated, new people were brought on. What's pretty clear is that there has not, in the short term, there was definitely some changes that were made. In the long term, it does not appear to have become a more welcoming place for people to speak up about problems.
You know, we've done so many shows about farm workers. I mean, we're talking about, these are workers in California. You also remind me when you're talking about garment workers who work in Southern California. They're paid just horrible wages. Do you know how much are these, the Primex workers paid?
I think Primex workers, you know what, I don't want to speculate right now. I have a number in my head, but I'm not positive. They are paid, I think, better than a lot of farm workers who work out in the field are paid. Often farm workers are paid at a piece rate. So that means that they're paid by the amount of a given crop that they're able to produce, whereas Primex is an hourly wage, so it's not as dependent on that. But you're right that in general the wages are horrific.
And who owns Primex? I'm looking on their website right now, and I can't find any. Is it an old family farm? Is it owned by a major corporation? Do you know?
So it's owned by. Primex itself is a pretty big corporation, and the packing facility is just one part of it. So it's kind of confusing. They don't own the farms themselves that produce the pistachios, but they do own this facility that, as you said, ends up packing 6% of the state's pistachios. And this company, it's honestly was quite murky for me to figure out at first as well. But yes, to your point, it is much bigger than just a family farm.
We don't have that much time left, Julia. In your piece, you go through the history of laws and really looking at how we got to this place. The lack of basic workplace protections for farm workers is by design. And we'd love to have you back to really do a whole show on that. You write that even in California, where farm workers have the right to collective bargaining and overtime pay, the laws on the books are not the laws in the fields. Fixing this broken system would require legislation to improve and expand federal worker protections. And, you know, this is a state run by Democrats. Democrats have a supermajority in Sacramento. are you ever able to interview politicians to ask why is this just, why does this go on and on year after year? I mean, especially during a pandemic.
You know, that's a great question. And I would love to do that more, but I think it actually ties back to what we were talking about at the beginning of farm workers not having a voice, in the way that perhaps farm owners, for example, have a voice, and others in the agricultural industry have a voice. And so it's really hard to then advocate for things like higher wages or collective bargaining. In California, they can collectively bargain, but in a lot of places, even something just as basic as being able to organize is not allowed.
In our final minute, in the conversations you had with the farm workers who went on strike, what really stood out for you? What is the message that they want to send?
One thing that stood out for me, especially talking with Veronica, was first the feeling that she never saw herself as an organizer, but this moment and this outbreak had sort of forced her into that position. And she was really inspired by the degree to which a lot of her coworkers at the time were willing to go out on that limb with her. And then on the other hand, it's been frankly really depressing to hear about the updates from her since then, and from other workers as well, to hear about how there have been these retaliatory measures taken. So I think that like she still has hope. She still is hopeful that the her labors will eventually bear fruit, maybe not in her generation, but in the future. But in the meantime, it's not going to be an easy ride.
Well, it's really an important piece. Thank you so much for your work on this, Julia, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Julia Lurie is a senior reporter at Mother Jones, and I hope you can take some time to read her piece, Everyone is Tired of Always Staying Silent Inside a Worker Rebellion in the Central Valley. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.